Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're in the last few days of February, and it's still Heart Month, so we'll take advantage of an opportunity to talk with an expert from St. Francis Hospital in Hartford about heart disease, particularly in women who often present drastically different symptoms and signs of heart disease than men. Then we'll check in with the National Brain Tumor Society's Connecticut chapter to learn more about how this agency supports and educates individuals about this critical medical condition. And we'll invite you to the upcoming Connecticut Brain Freeze fundraiser to benefit the cause. And we'll wrap up with our dear friends Ginger and Larry Katz. For 20 years, their Courage to Speak Foundation has been saving lives and empowering survivors to share their stories about loss from addiction to help save kids from becoming exposed to drugs and alcohol, in part through their upcoming Empowering Youth to be Drug-Free Family Night, which is happening in Norwalk on March 14th. We'll tell you all about that and how you can get involved. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this news. The Center for Children's Advocacy is hosting a Play for Kids event at Stanford's Chelsea Piers on Thursday, March 31st. Team events include friendly competitions at all levels, trampoline, dodgeball, rock climbing relays, obstacle courses, batting cages, and team building strategy challenges, all while raising funds to support the children. Center for Children's Advocacy work for vulnerable children throughout the state. If you'd like information about participating or sponsorship, call 860-570-5327 or just click on kidscouncil.org. Well, as we have been telling you in the introduction, this is the last program that we're going to be airing during February, which is Heart Month. And it's a time when we show the necessary amount of love to our cardiovascular system and anything that can interfere with it, giving us a long and healthy life. And we're so pleased to welcome a brand new friend to the program who's going to give us some very specific and important information. We're pleased to welcome Dr. Sabina Arora. She is a cardiologist and a congestive heart failure specialist with St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center. So, Dr. Arora, thank you for joining us this morning. I can tell you, we talked a few moments before we went on the air this morning, but I didn't get a chance to tell you that, sadly, my dad, I lost my dad due to congestive heart failure and some other complications. So it's a subject I am quite close to and a little bit familiar with as a as a loved one from a patient, but I'm glad we're focusing in on an issue that has been kind of growing concern and attention, and that is issues that are specific to women. So let's just quickly start off talking about some of the most important things that women need to know about the difference between their hearts and their cardiovascular systems and those of their male counterparts.
John, thank you for having me. I'm sorry about your father and that he suffered from congestive heart failure. I'm also, as you know, very familiar with the impact that has on families as well, because it tends to be a fairly chronic disease, heart failure, that is. With regards to the difference in the hearts of women and men from a physiologic standpoint, several differences exist. Typically, the diseases that more commonly affect men and women's cardiovascular systems are coronary artery disease, that is blockages in the blood vessels that supply the heart muscle with blood. Congestive heart failure is another condition that afflicts both women and men, and high blood pressure. There are other unusual illnesses that I don't feel compelled to discuss in greater detail right now. Mm-hmm. Now, with regards to the more common conditions, coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, and hypertension, how are men and women different in how they're afflicted by these diseases? As far as coronary artery disease is concerned, and just to be absolutely rudimentary, coronary artery disease is a condition that causes blockages in the blood vessels of the heart. Men tend to develop blockages in the blood vessels of the heart that may or not lead up to a heart attack at a younger age than women. The reason for that being women's reproductive hormones tend to protect their heart blood vessels for as long as they are premenopausal. Mm-hmm. So men develop coronary artery disease at a younger age and often less than 55 years of age. Women tend to develop blockages in the blood vessels of their heart at an older age and typically a few years after menopause. So one tends to notice blockages in blood vessels of women at the age of 55 or later. So 10 years later, 65 or later, that is 10 years later than their male counterparts.
So can I break at this point and just ask you then, from a completely uneducated standpoint, is there any science or evidence to indicate that the blockages that may develop in postmenopausal women actually kind of manifest or develop faster, sort of like when that menopausal switch changes in the physiology, does it cause a more intensive or a more rapid buildup?
Great question. And honestly, I'm not quite sure I know the answer, and I'm not sure science has divulged it yet. But what we do know is, and for the longest period of time, premenopausal women are relatively protected from blockages, and then they do seem to catch up rather quickly to their male counterparts in a 10-year span.
Oh, okay.
So my suspicion is that, yes, these blockages do develop, perhaps at a faster rate, or the hormones were protective in preventing them from manifesting. We are not quite sure which.
Okay.
Women present in their 70s if they have blockages in the blood vessels of their heart as opposed to their male counterparts who might be younger. Mm-hmm. They may or not have a different pattern in presentation. Meaning, what we have found in observational studies is that men have typically chest pressure, chest pain, and that prompts an evaluation in the emergency room or with their primary care physician or their cardiologist. Women may have somewhat more nonspecific symptoms. They may describe it as a chest tightness or have more vague symptoms or perhaps shortness of breath rather than chest pressure or chest pain, mm-hmm. which is more evident in their male counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
We also know, as far as coronary artery disease in women is concerned, that younger women also develop it, but however, at a younger age, they don't present with these symptoms. So if younger women have heart attacks, these are more often silent heart attacks, which goes back to what we were discussing earlier. Is it that the reproductive hormones really prevent development of coronary artery disease, or do they partially mask the symptoms? So there were a couple of studies, observational. One was in Iceland, and they followed women for nearly 29 years, and they followed 13,000 women.
Wow.
And they found that women at the age of 35 had evidence of a silent heart attack to the tune of 1.3 women in 1,000. But by the age of 70, about 60 out of 1,000 women had developed what were labeled silent heart attacks because they had never presented with any symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a pretty viable study with the amount of people and the length of...
Exactly.
It's rare.
It was a pretty large cohort of 13,000 women.
And rare to have 20-plus years of time.
That's right. Exactly. So there are other similar observations in other populations that have also demonstrated that yes, younger, certainly older women have more heart attacks than younger women,
mm-hmm.
and younger women have fewer heart attacks than younger men. However, younger women who have heart attacks don't present with any symptoms, mm-hmm. meaning they don't even know they had one, unless they undergo an incidental evaluation at the age of 50 or 60, or they present with heart muscle damage from prior silent heart attacks, meaning they don't typically present to their primary care physicians or to the emergency room with chest pain or chest pressure like younger men would with a heart attack.
Oh, so under what circumstances would a person routinely, through a medical exam or what have you, discover that they have prior cardiac and heart muscle damage?
Great question again. So sometimes, and I think that is increasingly evident, there are occupation-related health physicals. Mm-hmm. And someone presents to their primary care physician, either because they're going to fly a commercial aircraft or they're going to go into the armed forces. And more frequently, I think there is a trend towards wellness visits, which employers tend to have reimbursed from insurance companies. And it is all in favor of promoting preventative health exams to identify troubles before they become manifest.
Okay.
So in that context, a person may present for a routine physical and discover that they have high blood pressure but never had any symptoms from it. The burden of undiagnosed high blood pressure all over the world and in the United States is huge. Mm. And it is the single most modifiable risk factor for preventing downstream cardiac troubles.
Oh, okay.
So that's my plug for making sure that one does not have high blood pressure, because if that is identified and treated with medicines every day, the burden of heart attacks and heart failure downstream would reduce dramatically.
Oh, that's great to hear. I just want to let folks know that may have tuned in late as we are getting ready for our music and programming day, that we are on the final segment of the award-winning For the People for February. February is Heart Month, so appropriately we are talking about heart failure, and we have welcomed Dr. Sabina Arora with us. She is a cardiologist and congestive heart failure specialist with St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center. So in the last few minutes that we have with you, Dr. Arora, what are a couple of the most important things that you're advising patients and what the folks that are listening to the program need to know, especially if they may be women who are either have knowledge that they could be at risk because of high blood pressure, or maybe they have had these silent heart attacks before and they're now at greater risk?
So I think this is a common saying, a little bit of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I would emphasize having adequate cardiovascular health. And, you know, I would recommend regular exercise. I know we talk about it all the time, but it's worth reiterating. So even 30 minutes brisk walk 3 to 5 times a week adds up to having a healthier heart. Also, if folks have a family history of either parent or siblings having high blood pressure or heart attacks or strokes in the family before male relatives turned 55 or female relatives turned 65, they should certainly connect with their primary care physicians, make sure that they don't have high blood pressure, and if they do, that it is adequately treated with medicines. As far as high blood pressure medicines are concerned, we have many, many medicines now with very few or no side effects, and it's worth keeping their blood pressures under control if they have high blood pressure. Also, connecting with their primary care physicians, like I said, if they have a family history of heart disease or heart attacks or strokes, making sure that their cholesterol levels and their lipid profiles are normal. And if they are not, then they have a treatment plan that they discuss with their physician.
Very good.
If they have any change in exercise tolerance, for instance, I could climb a flight of stairs, in fact, several, last summer, and over the winter, I've gotten more and more tired and more short of breath, or my legs are swelling. Well, I would not at any age attribute all that to age alone and be dismissive of those symptoms. Even in the absence of chest pain or chest pressure, just more tiredness, more shortness of breath, or any or worsening swelling of the feet should be discussed with their primary care physician and prompt a cardiac evaluation.
Very good. Before we let you go on this last day of Heart Month, Doctor, any other pertinent points that folks of any age, or whether the male or female, need to know beyond the advice you've already given?
I think a healthy lifestyle promoted by regular exercise. I must emphasize, if you smoke, cut down and stop, because you're really burning up pieces of your heart with that cigarette. Following up with physicians if they have symptoms that are out of the ordinary should hopefully keep most of us well.
Excellent. Great advice, and great to welcome you to the For the People family of experts, Dr. Arora. Great to talk with you. Dr. Sabina Arora is a cardiologist and congestive heart failure specialist with St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center in Hartford, but great advice to all our listeners wherever they are. Dr. Arora, thank you so much for taking some time on the program this morning. So everybody knows what a brain freeze is, but we're going to give you a different perspective on what a brain freeze is in this morning's segment of the award-winning For the People. We're pleased to be on the line with some representatives of the National Brain Tumor Society. We're going to first be talking to a trio of folks from their office. Michael Antonellis is with us. He's the National Director of Marketing and Communications. Katie Federico is on board. She's Regional Director of Development for New England. And Angelique Kopilovich is also with us. She's Associate Director of Development as well for New England. If you haven't heard of this organization, agency is positioned to leverage resources and knowledge to deliver a huge impact to the brain tumor community through funding models, research collaborations, and a focused public policy agenda. They're driving change to improve the pace of drug discovery and development. So beyond that brief introduction, we'll start things out with Michael. Michael, thanks for sticking with us this morning and giving us some background on this important organization. Tell me a little bit more beyond that about the National Brain Tumor Society.
John, thank you so much for the opportunity. We really appreciate it. The National Brain Tumor Society is the largest and one of the most influential nonprofit organizations solely dedicated to the global brain tumor community. And, you know, we work really hard. We're fiercely committed to funding and driving research, public policy, to really help find better treatments and ultimately a cure for brain tumor patients. Our staff drives smart research funding strategies. We work with public policy and advocacy to really try to accelerate the pace of new discoveries to fight brain tumors. And we've contributed millions of dollars to high-impact brain tumor research over the years. We have very strong relationships with influential neurologists and clinicians and doctors all across the country and around the world.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad that I've got you guys on first before we talk to our local source, because I think I, along with a lot of folks, are sometimes confused unless we're intimately familiar or have a loved one or a close friend or a colleague who may have suffered or is going through a brain tumor situation. So I want to ask you about brain tumors and their impact, but couched in that, clarify any misconceptions that might be out there about whether or not all brain tumors are cancer.
So first of all, and this is Mike again, John, all brain tumors are not necessarily cancer. There are benign brain tumors and there are malignant brain tumors. Benign being a tumor that exists in the brain. Sometimes you can't get to it. It's not growing very quickly. And so it's a situation where people can live for very long amounts of time with a benign brain tumor. When you get into the stage 3 and stage 4 brain tumors that are cancerous, they do grow very quickly. Overall survival rate is a little bit low, and that's really what we're trying to fight for. We support people who have benign and malignant brain tumors, and there are over 120 different types of brain tumors. So we're really working with brain tumor patients across a very wide swath of genomes and tumor types. So that's really what we focus on. We try to service and work with brain tumor patients and researchers who are working on all 120. Of course, there are certain brain tumors like glioblastoma, which are much more devastating, and there's a real sense of urgency there. But we work with a number of different people across different brain tumor types.
So
currently, Yeah, go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say, that being said, Michael, there is a potential danger for even a slow-growing, benign brain tumor to the patient, right?
In some cases, yes, absolutely. And so that's why MRIs are very important in working with doctors and getting second opinions on tumors that are identified and diagnosed. That's very important for brain tumor patients. So you want to get the second opinion, and you want to try to get the type of treatment that's right for you. Everyone's different. And I think in the past, really, especially over the past 40 years or so, there have only been three approved treatments for brain tumors, drug treatments, and one device has been approved by the FDA. And what we're really trying to focus on more and more moving forward is precision medicine. So these are treatments that focus on the types of drugs or the type of therapy and treatments that are directed for each individual specifically. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're kind of moving towards in the near future. And a lot of the funding that we focused on is moving toward that precision medicine so that we can find better treatments for people.
So, Michael, just to take it off book briefly, when you're talking about brain tumors, are there situations where, are there more incidents where people are presenting to their doctor because they're feeling or showing the effects of brain tumors? Or would you say, and I'm not asking for hard statistics here, but is there an anecdotal feeling that more people's brain tumors, whether benign or malignant, are being discovered because they're sort of being found during medical examinations or interviews, or are they being treated because the patient is presenting with effects of those tumors?
Yeah, John, we don't have any true data or statistics about that. I think it happens both ways.
Mm-hmm.
When people have symptoms like severe headaches, trouble speaking, trouble with their balance. A lot of people say to themselves, "Well, it feels more than just a migraine headache or something like that." So people would go in and they ask for an MRI. Sometimes doctors can take a look at the list of symptoms and they'll say, "You know what? We recommend the MRI," and that's really one of the most accurate ways to find out if you have a brain tumor at all. There are some cases, and you've read them in the press, where people go in for a checkup and they feel that it was something minor, but then they actually have a diagnosis at some point that it is a brain tumor. So some people do present the symptoms, and other people just feel like even during a physical, you can find a brain tumor. But for the most part, MRIs are not recommended unless you are presenting symptoms. So it's really tough to determine in advance whether someone can, you know, have a brain tumor or not. It's, genetics really isn't a clear way of finding that out or discovering that. And so it's a little bit different, a little bit unlike other cancers out there. But there's a number of different factors that are being identified for why people develop brain tumors and why they develop a stage 3 or 4. And a lot of the researchers that we're working with, they're really doing cutting-edge research to find out what are the issues in terms of genome, and trying to take a look at the biomarkers that focus on and actually create the brain tumors. So we're funding a lot of great work, and researchers are learning more than they ever have about how brain tumors start and how they grow and how they kind of defend themselves. These tumors definitely change and evolve over time, and we're trying to find the best treatments.
Excellent.
There's nearly 700,000 people living with brain tumors right now in the country.
Hmm.
and another 70,000 will be diagnosed this year. And they just don't discriminate. You know, men, women, adults, kids, they have brain tumors. Right now, brain tumors are the leading cause of death for kids under 14 years of age and are the most prevalent cancer for people under 22 years of age. So it's kind of a dire situation. There's a real sense of urgency, but we're really seeing some very exciting research and new information about treatments.
Yeah, and I guess you're in that population group that is either, a little bit more off the radar. Maybe they're complaining, if they're young children, complaining to their parents about, some of the symptoms. But then you start aging into the teen and early adulthood where they're sort of in that invincible stage, like, I'm never, I'm getting headaches every couple of days, or I'm getting blurred vision, but there's no way it's a brain tumor. So the awareness of it and the input that you're giving is critically important. I really appreciate you taking the time to clarify those points. Michael Antonellis is the National Director of Marketing and Communications for this National Brain Tumor Society. We're going to give Michael a break now and come back to talk with a number of other guests representing the National Brain Tumor Society, and we'll get into some discussion about Connecticut's very first brain freeze to benefit the society. We'll be back. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Vauquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. As you're hearing, February is Heart Month, when we remind ourselves about the importance of taking care of our hearts and overall health. Now that many attempts at keeping New Year's resolutions about diet and exercise have maybe fallen a little short, it's time to face the facts about risks and consequences. Get Healthy CT, the regional wellness coalition of hospitals, health departments, and other health and social service providers, urges residents to take a higher level of accountability for your own health and to know your numbers for heart and diabetes. Learn more at gethealthyct.org. Katie Federico is on the line with us. She's one of the regional directors of development for New England. Katie, thanks for coming on the call. Tell us a little bit about the national events and programs that your organization is hosting to bring people closer to the organization, and maybe in some cases make them aware that maybe they're experiencing an issue themselves.
Yeah, absolutely, John. And like Michael said, we're really happy to be speaking with you this morning and helping us spread awareness about brain tumors. We do appreciate your time. Mm-hmm. So our national events program, we host 23 signature events throughout the country. And it's through our walks, our rides, our races, and now our first ever Polar Plunge, which is a Connecticut brain freeze. We're helping to connect the brain tumor patients, survivors, their caregivers, loved ones, friends, and we're really bringing them together for inspiring and family-friendly days. And really, John, what we find at our events is it's a great way for the brain tumor community to come together and feel as if they're not alone in this battle. And it's been really cool the past few months just seeing Angelique and Shauna and others in the planning committee just doing a really wonderful job at launching and growing our first event in Connecticut, which is the Brain Freeze.
Fantastic. Well, we are going to be talking to a member of the Connecticut Brain Freeze Initiative in just a few minutes. But in the meantime, we want to get a few words from Angelique Kapilevich. Is that right? Kapilevich? Angelique?
That's right. Yeah, Kapilevich.
So before we talk to our local representative, just tell us a little bit about the Connecticut Brain Freeze and other activities that are going on around it.
Sure. So this is our first Connecticut Brain Freeze. It will be held on Sunday, March 6th at the Seven Rock Conference Center in West Haven. Registration starts at 11 a.m. and the plunge will take place at 12:30 p.m. And to how to get involved, plungers can choose to participate as individuals, create a team, join an existing team. And these teams are led by captains close to the cause. And every individual is encouraged to set and meet fundraising goals with top participants recognized during our pre-plunge ceremony. Every plunger receives a personal fundraising plate, page and online tools to help with their fundraising efforts. Mm-hmm. And each of our participants is encouraged to raise a minimum of $100 or more, with youth participants ages 8 and up are encouraged to raise a minimum of $50.
And people
we
can
also
get,
have wonderful incentives. I'm sorry.
No, people can get started by going to braintumor.org and tracking through to the local event.
Exactly. Yeah, you would visit www.braintumor.org/CTBrainFreeze to register and or to donate.
And there are some other collateral things going on around the main event?
Yeah, so we'll have an opening ceremony before the plunge inside the conference center, and we'll have activities like a costume contest, a section which plungers can create signs to honor or remember loved ones. And there's also many opportunities for participants to interact with others who are going through a similar experience.
And if people can't specifically get involved in this first Connecticut Brain Freeze, they could still support the organization in many other ways through donations or possibly even other volunteer efforts or hosting some sort of a fundraising activity themselves. You get started at braintumor.org for all of that, as well as to get signed up and get more information on the Connecticut Brain Freeze. We want to just quickly let folks know that we're going to be talking with Shauna Edie Pendleton. She's the brain tumor advocate and committee member for the Connecticut Brain Freeze in just a moment. But finally, we'll go back to Michael Antonellis, who's the National Director of Marketing and Communications. Michael, we've got about 30 seconds. If you could just let people know the most important reason why people should invest or donate or support the National Brain Tumor Society.
John, I'll say that more than ever before, we're seeing a shift, an inflection point in the fight against brain tumors. We see unprecedented momentum with new genome analysis being done, and researchers really feel like they have a new level of understanding in how to treat and eventually cure brain tumors. And so there's really a sense of urgency right now. You may know someone who has a brain tumor, and you folks out there, maybe someone in the future that you know will have a brain tumor. So time is really of the essence, and we hope that you folks can give and volunteer and become part of these events, and we really appreciate your time and your commitment. John, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Great, Michael. Thank you. And now let's switch gears and talk to one of the passionate folks that are behind our first ever Brain Freeze coming up here in Connecticut. We're on the line now, as promised, with Shauna Edie Pendleton. Is that right? Edie.
Yeah.
Shauna Edie Pendleton. She's a brain tumor advocate and committee member for the Connecticut Brain Freeze, and she has a brain tumor experience to tell you about. Shauna, let's hear about how you came to know this organization, how you developed your inspiration and passion to get involved in this Connecticut Brain Freeze, the first one we're ever going to have here in the state, and about Kenny.
The first time we got involved with the National Brain Tumor Society, we were in a car ride. My husband had been diagnosed with a brain tumor back in 2008, and that was before we were married. We were in a car ride, and his aunt approached us about possibly participating in the Brain Tumor Walk Boston does one every year. She just wanted permission because it was going to be the week before our wedding, and she didn't know if I'd be okay with it, but, you know, anything for a good cause, right? Mm-hmm. So that's actually how they came into our lives. So in our car ride up to there where our aunt approached us, we were actually on our way to meet Kenny's new doctors up at Mass General. Mm-hmm. He unfortunately had suffered a massive seizure that year, and the past 4 years had been, 4 or 5 years had been pretty stable with his tumor, hadn't really been growing, but it had started growing again, and they thought that surgery was his only option and maybe some rounds of chemotherapy, radiation, and unfortunately, Kenny lost his battle in July of 2014, and it was about 8 months after he got married, so... Yeah.
So you need not say more. That's
sorry.
I don't know any greater inspiration than losing the person you love the most. So it certainly speaks to why you're so passionate and involved in the cause. Tell me a little bit real quick about putting together the role you're playing in the Brain Freeze.
Yeah, so my husband liked to dream big, and he always, because we participated in the Boston Walks, he really wanted to have an event in Connecticut, you know, just mainly to get the word out and to get people involved in our own state. And so after he had passed, and, you know, we continued to do the walks and be involved with the National Brain Tumor Society, but we wanted an event in Connecticut, and, you know, we just kept talking to people, and they thought that it would be a great idea. And, you know, we just kept looking for options and ideas, and that's how the Connecticut Brain Freeze was pretty much formed. So
for the purposes of folks that might have joined the conversation late, can you just give them the quick rundown on the date, location, and we'll remind folks if they want to learn more either about the organization or get patched through to register and put a team together for the Brain Freeze, they can go to braintumor.org.
Yep, it's March 6th at Savin Rock. And I believe we will be going in the water around 11.
Well, Shauna, I'm terribly, terribly sorry for your loss, and just inspired by what you're doing and how you're carrying on so admirably in the face of what happened to you. But it also speaks to how important it is for folks to be aware. We heard some very, very incredible and disturbing statistics about how brain tumors are becoming much more prolific amongst younger people and children. And so it's more important than ever now for folks to get to know the organization and to be able to get involved in this event. So we thank you for participating in the interview this morning, and we'll see you out at Savin Rock for the first ever Connecticut Brain Freeze to benefit the National Brain Tumor Society. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's tough to talk about, and
sorry about that.
No, we really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll see you. We'll see you in West Haven. Thank you.
Sounds good.
I'm so glad to welcome back into the studio some great friends of ours here at Connoisseur Media and across all our radio stations, Ginger and Larry Katz, and the Courage to Speak Foundation has been saving lives since their family suffered an ultimate tragedy. And now, 20 years strong, Connecticut's best-kept secret is everywhere, from California to Florida to Maine to Nevada, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Wisconsin. All over the country, presentations have been taking place. There are communities that are reading Ginger's book, Sunny's Story, all over the country, and they have workshops and facilitators and drug prevention programs launching or in place all over Connecticut, a couple of dozen different school systems, as well as in Indiana, North Carolina, Massachusetts, Maryland, Michigan, and beyond. I'm so happy to welcome them back here, not only to celebrate 20 years strong of working to keep children and our communities safe, but also to celebrate their upcoming 12th annual Courage to Speak, Empowering Youth to be Drug-Free Family Night. That's coming up in March. And we want to invite everyone in the state of Connecticut out to this great event happening in Norwalk. And that is on the 14th of March. We'll tell you more about that. But let's check in with the Katzes, who are in studio with us. Ginger, welcome. Congratulations, 20 years strong, of course, you wouldn't have had any of those 20 years if you had a choice.
You're right, John. It feels like yesterday sometimes. It's been 20 years that Ian has been gone. He'd be 40 years old.
Mm-hmm. So in these 20 years, it seems like almost every year the effort has doubled or better, mm-hmm. but it really has seemed to gain maximum traction really over the past 5 or 6 years. And well, certainly since the family night has been in place. But I mean, you really started, I guess, once Sunny's Story was produced, and you really started getting traction around the country.
Yeah, you're right. For the first 12 years, I worked in Ian's room in the basement. And the 12th year, by the 12th year, we developed the elementary, middle, high school and parenting program called Courageous Parenting 101.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to get it evaluated. So I was lucky enough to get a federal grant. And you're saying 7 years, you're right on, you know, 7-8 years.
Mm.
That's when we really built our capacity, because we evaluated all those programs through Yale School of Medicine. And that helped us reach out across the country with our programs. But it started in Norwalk, Connecticut. And then it went to Bridgeport, Waterbury, and other towns in Connecticut wanted our programs as well. And I used to present, and I still do, Ian's story. But I knew the students and the parents wanted more. So we got together teams of experts in prevention to work with our school system in Norwalk and develop these programs. So we have a program for elementary, middle, and high school. And this is a celebration that night of the children coming out. And they're also speaking.
Another interesting aspect is that you have really been embraced by the community, by the Norwalk School District.
Yeah.
And I guess once that seed is planted and you do have that track record of both collaboration and success, it really helps open the door for other school districts whose staffs are often overwhelmed with program options and testing and conformity and everything beyond just the hands-on work of teaching. But educators and prevention and recovery and resiliency professionals in communities now, not just across the state but around the country, are sort of seeing the gift that you gave to the community of Norwalk, and they want it to.
Yeah, and we developed it as a team, and it just grew. And somebody said, when you build it, they will come. And then I did the responsible thing by getting all the programs evaluated by Yale School of Medicine. I went to the government, and I received federal funding. And I was able to bring in staff and bring in consulting groups, and we just expanded tremendously. But it's word of mouth. Most of the time, we are booked for our presentations by word of mouth. They hear about the book Sunny Story, which is narrated by the Family Beagle. It's Ian's story.
Mm.
He tells the story of his best friend and how he lost him. And also the curriculum. There are 8 sessions for elementary, 10 for high school, and 15 for middle schools. And the children like it, and they enjoy, and the teachers enjoy teaching it, because it's the connection of Ian's story, and they embrace it, and they keep their vow after hearing that, but then the teachers give the tools so the students will keep their vow.
Mm. It's one thing for even like a DARE officer or a school resource officer or even a celebrity to stand up in front of young people. But at a certain age, those young people are much more receptive to something that they could relate to, like a pet.
Mm-hmm.
So that had to have played a very, very important role.
Yeah, I remember sitting on the deck, and Sonny, the Family Beagle, was sitting there with my friend and I, and I looked down at Sonny and I said, Sonny, if you could talk, you would have a lot to say. Mm. You knew every move Ian made. You sensed everything. And then a light bulb went off, and that's when I decided to write Sonny's story from the perspective, Ian's story, rather, from the perspective of the dog, Sonny. So the dog narrates Ian, starting with a sip of beer, some cigarettes, and pot. And then progressively through the years, the addiction just grew and grew. And those drugs led Ian to the drugs that killed him, which was heroin and Valium mix.
Mm. And while, you know, today, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this in the next few minutes, but you cannot open a newspaper, a magazine, the internet, turn on a radio or television without seeing, for 5 minutes, without seeing something related to the opioid epidemic.
You're right.
The president is talking billions of dollars in investments. States are doing all kinds of work. But you stepped out of the shadows that so many parents put themselves into 20 years ago because you refused to be stigmatized by the truth.
Yeah, it's true. Doctors told us to tell people Ian died of an aneurysm or a heart attack. and it was 2 o'clock in the morning right before the funeral. And the day of the wake, I held a lot of young women who wore long black dresses in my arms and young men that cried like little boys, and they wanted to know what happened to Ian. And we were telling them, and we were waiting for the toxicology report, but we knew. I'm thinking about what the doctors told us to say, so we were stifled by that. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I knew I couldn't make it to the funeral the next day. So I woke Larry up, and I said, I can't do this. And I said, I want to speak out. I can't go to the funeral unless we speak out. And he immediately said yes. And when we went to the funeral, and we buried our beloved son, and we started to speak out. And Ian was a good kid. He made an unhealthy decision to use drugs, but I never lied about him, and I wasn't going to lie at his death. I was not ashamed of him.
So from day one,
you were reaching parents, you were reaching people.
That...
Oh, my priest from St. Thomas came to me. Ian's principal of the high school. People came from New Haven, Hartford, and one man said, you have a jewel in your community. She's talking about it. People are going under the covers. They're not speaking about it. They're lying about their children dying. Mm. And I always was the type of person that if I saw something that needed to be fixed, I wanted to fix it. I wanted to find solutions. So for some way, something happened, and people started to ask me to speak out. So I started to speak about Ian's story, and I coined the presentation, the Courage to Speak presentation. And I began to get invitations from schools all over the country, the national secondary school principals, independent schools. I was invited to the DEA, and they used to send me with their DEA agents to speak. And it just started. But then I realized that the kids and the parents needed more. They needed curriculum. And that's what we did. And we developed these. And family night is where the children come out and they speak because they have taken the curricula in school. And they got the message. They have all these activities, these lesson plans based on Ian's story and all the most updated. I was very responsible with the Yale School of Medicine evaluations too, and we're a team. I partner with schools to implement these programs.
If you're just joining us, Ginger and Larry Katz are in the studio. 20 years with the Courage to Speak Foundation. Right now, they are reaching almost 19,000 subscribers to their electronic newsletter. They've been in almost 450 newspaper articles on almost 120 TV programs. They've been on my program a dozen times or more in the past 20 years. Certainly almost every year since the Courage to Speak Empowering Youth, the Family Night, has been around. And we'd like to invite you, the foundation trains classroom teachers and professional facilitators to teach their drug prevention program and coordinate community events fostering commitment to drug prevention education and saving lives of young people because they don't want to see anyone else go through what happened to them, and they're still seeing it. As we talked about before we went on the air, more than 8 individuals a week in Connecticut just last year died from opiate overdoses. So they would like to invite anyone within the sound of our voices to Connecticut, to Norwalk, to the 12th Annual Courage to Speak Empowering Youth to be Drug-Free Family Night. It's Monday, March 14th, beginning at 5:45 p.m. at West Rocks Middle School on West Rocks Road in Norwalk. And it's got a great program, and one of the folks on that program is the other half of the Katz team, who, while Ginger has been very successful with her book, Larry Katz, co-founder of Courage to Speak Foundation, will be reading a very touching letter that he has written called Dear Child. There'll be other great events and a raffle and speakers. But the bottom line is the stats. 1 out of 5 fifth graders have been drunk. Prescription painkillers are the new gateway drug to heroin among 12 to 17-year-olds. And kids reduce drug use by 65% if middle school prevention programs are in place. So there's no reason not to get in touch with the organization. CourageToSpeak.org is the website. So what I'd like to talk about before we put the final word out on the event, Ginger, is the Parenting 101 program. How do people get involved with that? And Larry, please join us on the microphone if you would.
All right, thank you. Yeah, the parenting course, we felt that when we go to communities, we would speak to the schools, and then we would speak to the parents that night. And we realized that the parents needed more and more information, because we would be sitting there finishing our presentation, answering all the questions, and people weren't moving. Mm. They were just sitting there just trying to absorb all of the information that we've given them. So we realized they needed more. And as a result, with the help, again, of experts, we developed a curriculum for parents, how to talk to your children to successfully guide them through those critical years of growing up without using drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And the course has actually, we started in Norwalk, and we had the support of the schools, and we had over 125 parents come out, which is like unheard of in prevention to get that many people out. And the course is now offered online, and we have facilitators throughout the country now teaching it. We have, I think, 116 at this point teaching the program in the different communities. So, and the people that do teach it have a background in prevention or have some counseling background or something like mm-hmm. that, because they're able to answer questions.
Yeah, and the bottom line is that even for the parents who take the class and are able to communicate with their own children, those kids have visitors to their home. Certainly the visitors to the home, who oftentimes are the ones that are going through the medicine cabinets and getting some of those drugs that might end up getting them hooked, they're hearing the message too. They're getting the reinforcement. So if you're a parent out there and you take this workshop, you never know the difference that you might make in the lives of someone beyond your own family. So it's a great point. Ginger?
It's really about the health and safety of your children. It's every child will be asked to smoke, to drink, to take this pill. Every child is at risk. And even if you think your child will never do drugs, you still have to find out everything they're going to be exposed to. Mm-hmm. And this is a four-session program, four evenings, once a week. It's called prevention, and it's about the health and safety of your home and raising healthy kids to make good decisions.
Excellent.
And I just want to say that it's the number one deterrent. They ask, you know, how could you stop kids from using drugs? The number one deterrent is parents' an ongoing conversation about this subject, because they do have the ability to get through to their children.
And
even if they looks like they're not listening, they are listening.
Yeah, and the power of sitting around together at the right. family dinner table, is what you're reinforcing.
One in three kids have that conversation with their parents. So that means two-thirds of children coming to school today do not have that conversation. So we want to get to the kids, but we want to get to the parents as well.
Yeah, and you can make drug-free family night the beginning of a long family tradition in your home by attending. We've got a couple minutes left, Ginger, so just give folks the rundown on how the evening is going to roll out.
Okay, first we have a dinner at 5:45, pizza, pasta, salad. The area restaurants have all donated. I have so many great people that have given us funding for this event and sponsored the event, and it's still available. Sponsorships are still available. Just give us a call or go to visit our Courage to Speak website. But in any event, it starts off with a dinner, and then at 6:30 we go into the auditorium where Senator Barb Duff is our MC. I believe we're getting a letter from the Office of the President, Office of National Drug Control Policy, to be read. And then the mayor, the superintendent, and chief of police of Norwalk will introduce the students to read their vows not to use drugs after hearing Ian's story. Mm-hmm. And then I will give a half-hour presentation. It's about 50%, 40% of what I usually do, but it still gets to the point, and it's very powerful, quiet and soft, but very powerful. And parents, if they hear it for the first time, will really understand why their children are so connected to our programs.
Excellent. After losing their 20-year-old son, Ian, our guests this morning, Ginger and Larry Katz, pledged to do everything in their power to help prevent those tragedies from happening to another family. Here, 20 years later, the Courage to Speak Foundation is stronger and more widely known than ever in doing work throughout the country, not just here in Connecticut. Connecticut's best-kept secret for saving children's lives is now everywhere across the country. We know folks might be listening on podcasts, on iTunes. No matter where you are, you can go to CourageToSpeak.org, get in touch, get them in your school district, get them sitting with parents in your community, and come on out on the 14th of March to the 12th Annual Courage to Speak Empowering Youth to be Drug-Free Family Night. It's happening at West Rocks Middle School in Norwalk. It's open to everyone. The snow date is the next evening, although I don't think we'll need it. And we hope you'll get in touch and get all there is to benefit from the Courage to Speak Foundation. It's CourageToSpeak.org. Once again, Ginger and Larry, we welcome you back. We're proud to be helping to support the Courage to Speak Foundation all these years. Connoisseur Media and all our radio stations are right there behind you, and we appreciate and value the great work you're doing in the communities here in Connecticut and now around the country. Happy 20th anniversary to the Courage to Speak Foundation. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People. Or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.